This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With just a little more than a week left in the Clinton presidency, we're going to look back on life in the Clinton White House. Our first guest is Paul Begala. He and James Carville ran the campaign that got Clinton into the White House. Begala later served as the president's political advisor. Begala is now a research professor at Georgetown University and a political analyst at MSNBC. He's also one of the people interviewed on the ABC Nightline and PBS Frontline co-production, The Clinton Years. Begala says when he met Clinton, he felt a stronger connection than he had with any other candidate he'd worked with.
It was the political equivalent of love at first sight. I'd been in the business for a while, and we had a mutual friend, Zell Miller, who was the governor of Georgia, whose campaign I had run, who was urging Clinton to hire James Carville and I, my partner. And we met with Clinton in 1991, and I was swept off my feet. I had never before had a politician who talked to me like I was a person and a citizen first and a strategist second. He didn't just say, here's how we can win New Hampshire and then get the nomination. And then he talked about his ideas. He talked about his daughter. He talked about the kind of country he wanted. And I was utterly charmed. I was completely swept off my feet.
And what did it mean to you that he talked about ideas?
Most politicians begin with the strategy and then work on the rationale. They begin by saying, well, my wife is from Illinois, and so that can help us in the Midwest, and I went to school in the Northeast, so that can help. And so they work backwards from there. They work through the how first, and then they tend to not want to think about the why. And he did it the right way. He did it the more difficult way, the more intellectually rigorous way. He began by saying, why should I be president? What ideas can I bring? And he had a very compelling case that the things he had worked on in Arkansas, education and economic development, were going to move center stage in a world in which there was no longer this central organizing principle of the Cold War. And it was very impressive analysis.
When you were first working with Clinton as a presidential candidate, what were some of the qualities you thought were his strongest ones and other qualities you thought he maybe had to change or hide from view?
His strongest quality is his empathy. Now, I say that even though he's the smartest person I know. He's an incredibly bright guy, but there are a lot of bright people in politics. I do think he's the brightest, but more than that, more impressive is the empathy. There are a lot of politicians who can sort of turn it on when the cameras are on, but then otherwise don't really care very much about people as individuals. He had this incredible ability to connect with people and to care about them, and it was real. It was right to the depth of his being, and I think that particularly showed itself on matters of race. He had the best ability to try to understand the racial divide in America and try to bridge it. Now, in terms of drawbacks, I mean, we all have them. I mean, certainly he had had stumbles in his life that he didn't want people to know about, and I found that to be eminently human and quite forgivable. Like a lot of politicians, he also sometimes wanted to get 100% of the vote instead of just the 51% you need to lead. That changed over time. I think by the time he became president and was working particularly with an opposition Republican Congress, he understood that there were some people that no matter what he did would never support him, and he reconciled himself to that. But at the start, I think he'd have been happy if he could have gotten 100%.
Now, the empathy, which you mentioned, is something that he was both liked for and also mocked for. So many of the comics did the whole I feel your pain thing, or him biting his bottom lip and right. You know, in sign of thoughtfulness and sensitivity. Do you ever think the empathy got overplayed for the cameras?
No. I know that you're right, that he got a lot of criticism for that, but it was real, and I thought it was wonderful, and I think it's one of the reasons the American people hung in there with him for so long. That line, I feel your pain, he blurted out in a real, in a fit of pain. He was in New York, and he was giving a speech, and an AIDS activist stood up and was yelling at him that the government hadn't done enough about AIDS, that he in Arkansas perhaps had not done enough about AIDS. And he didn't patronize the man. He engaged him. He argued with him. And then finally, it just came pouring out of him. He said, you know, I feel your pain, and I am trying to do something about it, and I want to go to Washington to make sure we do more. Well, you know, he has. I mean, obviously, we still have AIDS. It's still a terrible, terrible disease and a crisis. But he's done a lot more for that issue and that disease than any prior president. Certainly, President Reagan could never bring himself to even say the word. So I, to this day, have always loved and admired him for his empathy and his ability to feel other people's pains. And I think it's probably one of the most important things a president can have, because it's a very isolating office. It's a place where everybody kisses your ring, where you're treated quite well physically. There's very little harm that can come your way, thank goodness. But I do think it also tends to isolate and kind of deaden the soul a little bit if you're not someone who's very well connected to how real people live.
When you took on the Clinton campaign with James Carville, did you check out his past and see what personal skeletons might be in the closet?
No, we didn't. You hear rumors about everybody, but this is what we did for a living, was work for politicians. I was more interested in what he stood for. I was more interested, frankly, in his prospects of winning. Those are the two things that I checked out. I talked to other politicians who I respected, and I mentioned before Zell Miller, who was then the governor of Georgia. He's now a senator from Georgia. I talked to people like that, but I was not interested in trying to root around to see if he was somehow, morally fit. I don't like that kind of politics.
But those skeletons became your problems. What was your reaction when the Jennifer Flowers story broke?
I was nauseous. And to this day, when I think about it or hear about it, it kind of turns my stomach for a variety of reasons. First off, at some level, I feel his pain. Unfortunately, there's a whole lot of people in life who have challenges in their marriage. That's tragically common. What's not common is to have your marriage strip searched like that in front of the whole world. And I just can't imagine what it must be like to have your weakest moments splayed out there for the entire world. I never did feel like it was anybody's business except his and Hillary's. And, call me old-fashioned, but I'd pin a medal on the two of them for holding it together. I mean, he is still married to a gal he met in the library 25 years ago. And they've had their ups and downs, but that's better than 50% of the married population in America.
Is there anything you learned through the Clinton campaign that disproved any of your own theories about campaigning?
Yeah, a lot. One was, everybody believed in this business that given what happened to Gary Hart, if there were plausible charges of infidelity, that was the end of it for you. One of the things Clinton taught me is if you just don't give up, if you just don't give in, you can survive. He is the most resilient guy I've ever seen. And I think that is undervalued in politics. We tend to want these people just to go away when they're hit with a scandal. And very often they just want to go away because they can't take it. And he just has this incredible, incredible resilience, this ability to carry on without becoming bitter, without obsessing about it, but instead really trying to put it aside in a box and move on with the job he's being paid to do. I just didn't think anybody could possibly just get up in the morning after some of the days that he had, and he was always ready to. And that proved to me that if you're willing to take the punch, people will give you the credit and let you dust yourself off and move on.
Paul Begala is my guest, and he helped run President Clinton's campaign with James Carville, and he was a political advisor in the Clinton White House from 1997 to 1999. Robert Reich, who was Secretary of Labor during the early part of the Clinton administration, said that when he was given an order, he started asking if the person that gave the order was under 30, and if they were under 30, he'd refuse to do it. Was there a generation gap in the White House?
Yes, and I was always struck that the baby boomers who used to say, don't trust anyone over 30, all of a sudden didn't trust anyone under 30. I thought there was an enormous tension between the kids, and I suppose I was one of the kids.
Well, you were 30. You were kind of right in that transition.
Boomers. I was right there. I was the middle child.
Right.
I was caught
that in-between age.
Yeah, I found that odd, but real. I mean, here we had a president who had been the governor of his state when he was about 31 or 32, about my age. And yet sometimes he would look at some of these people younger than him and say, well, my goodness, they're young. But, our current vice president-elect, Dick Cheney, was the White House chief of staff at age 31 or 32. When Bill Moyers and Ted Sorensen had some of the most senior jobs in the White House for Presidents Johnson and Kennedy, they were in their very early 30s. So it's always been that way. I think, though, that with the baby boomers, they were always used to being the youngest person in the room. And all of a sudden, the president and Bob Reich and some of the others looked up and they said, oh my goodness, they're talking to us like we're nearing 50. And they were. And I think it shook out over time and everybody adjusted to the change.
My guest is Paul Begala. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about life in the Clinton White House with Paul Begala, who was the president's political advisor after co-running the campaign that got him elected. There must have been a strange transition that happened in your relationship with Bill Clinton when he went from being the person who you were advising in his presidential campaign to actually being Mr. President. Did the relationship change? And if so, how? Maybe you can give us an example of how relating to Bill Clinton changed once he became the president.
You're right, Terry. It changed very quickly and very dramatically. I traveled with him through the campaign. I sat next to him on the plane. We had endless, wonderful, wide-ranging conversations about music and religion a lot. I'm a Catholic. He's a Baptist. I grew up in the Bible Belt. He went to Catholic schools, and so we each have a real interest in the other's religious tradition. We talked, obviously, a lot about politics, but also about family. I was just starting to have children, and he had told me the whole story of how he and Hillary got to have Chelsea. So we developed a very intimate relationship, and the morning after the election, he said to me, "I want you to call me Bill. It's important that you call me Bill." And I looked at him and I said, "You know, I never called you Bill when you were just the governor of Arkansas. I can't call you Bill now. You're the president-elect." And there was a transition period where he seemed hesitant, almost uncomfortable with the trappings of power. And it took us all a while, I think, to readjust and to become comfortable with the majesty of the office and that part of the function, which President Reagan understood intuitively because of his experience as an actor. He understood that there's a role-playing function there. President Clinton, being of a different generation, I think wanted to demystify the presidency quite a bit, and I think he did to an extent, but I also think we came to understand the value and the power of the majesty and the moment of the presidency.
Well, as an advisor, as you started to get a better understanding of the majesty of the office, how did that change, if at all, the advice you gave Clinton about how he should relate to the public?
I had to be a lot more careful about what I said to him. The campaign is obviously a very small group of people. Maybe even most key decisions were made by half a dozen of us or less. And then you move into the government, and even a meeting with six people in it becomes front page news in the New York Times the next day. And so I had to become very careful. I made it my business to be as in private as critical as I could and in public as praising as I could. That's my definition of loyalty. I think a loyal aide has to really hammer the president when you're alone, when there's nobody else in the room, because they get a whole lot of sugar-coated information. How that changes in how you relate to the public, I've always been struck that the public, at least to me, they always call him Bill. Every time I travel, people say, "How's old Bill doing? You know, Bill did a good job on that crime bill. You ought to congratulate him for that." They feel a sense of ownership of this guy, I think, because they created him, and then they sustained him. When everybody in Washington wanted to get rid of him, it was just popular opinion and average, what Clinton calls walking around folks, that sustained him. So I think they always saw him as their guy in Washington. And even when he became more comfortable with the trappings of power, and God, he loves Hail to the Chief now, believe me, he never seemed to leave those kind of walking around folks out.
Now, you said that you tried to be very critical in private and very supportive in public. I think we've all seen you being very supportive of Clinton on television. Maybe you can compare for us an issue in which what you said in public was different from what you said in private.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of issues where I would privately disagree with him, but then once a decision is made, you've got to get on board. I mean, the most carefully documented one was the whole economic plan that Clinton put together, where I, as his political advisor, said, "Look, if you promise a middle-class tax cut and then begin with a tax increase, even a small one on gasoline like we had, people can be very upset." It didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that would hurt him politically. He made the decision that it was more important. I was really proud of that decision. Here was this intensely political animal, knowing full well he was going to take an action that would be very politically damaging, but he thought it would be good for the economy, thought it would be good for the country. So I publicly defended that economic plan. I helped him to sell it, and I was happy to do so, even though there were a lot of particulars in there that I didn't much like. My view is that's the price of teamwork, is that you make your argument, you state your case in the strongest possible terms. And then once a decision is made, unless it's something that completely runs contrary to your conscience, you've got to support it.
Well, because you were such the public supporter all the time and often on the TV talk shows, speaking out in support of President Clinton, even early on in the Monica Lewinsky story, you were speaking on his behalf when very few other people would. Did you ever find yourself saying things that you weren't sure you really believed?
Well, I had no idea what the truth was. That was a terrible time. That was really dancing in the dark. You know, like he never told me anything different than he told the public at large. He said, "You've got to believe me. This stuff isn't true." And to his credit, he said, "I can't tell you anymore, or they'll drag you into it, and you'll be in front of the grand jury, and you'll have $100,000 of legal bills, and I don't want that for you. I'm going to handle this, but you just got to believe it's not true." I know he shouldn't have done that, and I had a very hard time with that. When I realized finally, and he came forward and said that he had in fact had an affair, you know, I came very close to resigning, and I would have resigned, but for the fact that they tried to impeach him. And then it became a question of where do I owe my highest duty? And it seemed to me I was paid by the taxpayers to serve the Constitution. And even if I was angry with my friend, the president, and I was furious, I had a higher duty to the country to try to stop what I felt was an absolutely illegitimate and partisan impeachment. You know, if they had done with Clinton what the Democrats did with Reagan over Iran-Contra, which is to say, we're not going to impeach you, but we want the whole country to know you lied. You lied to us, Mr. President. You said we didn't trade arms for hostages, and we did. I don't know that I could have stayed with him then, but he, in that sense, was saved by his enemies because they once again tried to go so far, and it showed me that it really wasn't about anybody's sense of morality at all. It was just about power and politics, and I then felt very comfortable in defending him because I felt like I was defending the Constitution more than Bill Clinton, the man.
You had defended Bill Clinton back when he was saying that he didn't have a relationship with Monica Lewinsky. Then you learned the truth, and you went through this period of thinking maybe you'd resign, as you just described. When you went back on TV, Ted Koppel asked you this question. He said, "Since you were sent out on a number of occasions to lie in the president's behalf, what guarantees do I have? What guarantees do our viewers have that you aren't being sent out now to do the same thing?" Did you feel that your support of the president early on was seen as a reflection of your credibility or your lack of credibility? Was it personally upsetting to you that you had said things that you later found out weren't true?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Of course, I had no idea that they were false. I would have never said them if I'd known that. But it did damage my credibility, as it has to. And I thought Ted's question, while brutally tough, was perfectly fair. It was the only honest way to begin that kind of an interview. When the president came forward and confessed that he'd in fact had an affair that he had told me to deny, I went through, as I said, a very difficult time, and I went for quite some time refusing all interviews, refusing to defend him in public any longer. And what changed my mind and sent me back out was watching the videotape of Clinton being interrogated by the special prosecutors. And they asked him questions that nobody should be asked. The most tawdry, intimate details of his worst moments, even after he began the session by confessing to having had an affair. They didn't take that confession, and they just said, "Well, we're going to try to humiliate you." And I was so moved by what I thought was this manifest mistreatment that my friend had received that it actually helped me to forgive him. It didn't make it all right, and it didn't excuse it. But, you know, in my religious tradition, if someone comes to you and says, "I've done something wrong, I am asking for your forgiveness," it's not easy. In fact, it was enormously difficult, and maybe I haven't perfectly achieved it yet. But it's my obligation to forgive, or else it becomes my sin. And so that's what was going on inside of my heart and my head. But I thought it was perfectly fair for journalists to say, how can we believe you now when you told us things that were false in the past? And it's why in my comments from then on, I confined myself to the known and provable public record. And then 6 days after he was acquitted by the Senate, I quit.
And why did you quit then?
Well, my work was done. I didn't want to continue on. I had spent a very, very intense couple of years on the White House staff. And I felt like defeating this completely illegitimate impeachment had probably taken the last full measure of what I had to give my country and my president. It was probably better for him to get a team of fresh horses in there. And I do think that he needed new people and fresh faces because of the the difficulty and the divisiveness of that fight, and also because of that long period when he was simply unable or unwilling, rather, to confess to this affair.
Did you or any other consultants in the White House or aides in the White House ever give Clinton a keep it in your pants kind of lecture?
It's not. I was not his nanny. No, that's not my job. I don't know whether anyone else did, but he's an adult, and it's not my business. I'm not in the habit of telling my friends how to live their private lives, much less my employers.
Paul Begala is President Clinton's former political advisor. He'll be back in the second half of the show. One correction, in Robert Reich's interview for the Nightline Frontline series, he said he didn't want to take orders from people under 40, not under 30, as I said earlier. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about life in the Clinton White House. Let's get back to our interview with Paul Begala. He and James Carville ran the campaign that got Clinton into the White House. Begala later served as the president's political advisor. Bill Clinton spoke of Hillary as his greatest asset during the campaign and used to say, you know, if you make me president, you're getting two for the price of one. Now, some of Clinton's advisors complained that Hillary had perhaps too much power in the relationship because nothing that the aides wanted done would get done, even if Clinton agreed to it, unless Hillary agreed as well. Do you think that that's an accurate reading of the relationship? And was her say in policy, in your mind, a good thing, or did it interfere, do you think, with things that you were trying to get done?
For 17 years, I guess, have been dealing with politicians. I no longer do it for a living. But everyone I ever worked for who was married had an influential spouse. And that just goes with the territory. I mean, I worked for Dianne Feinstein for a while. She's a senator from California. And I used to start every day by calling her husband, Dick Blum, and seeing what he thought about things. I mean, any smart staffer is going to want to know what the principal's spouse thinks, because that man or woman is always going to have the last word if they have any kind of a normal relationship. I can understand how it's difficult for staff people, but I guess I always knew that that came with the territory. It was always the same, as I say, with every senator, every governor I ever worked for. And it's part of the human condition. If you're married and you're any kind of a decent spouse, you're going to listen to your spouse.
Do you feel that you understand why people on the right so despise Hillary and Bill Clinton? Why it became so personal?
No, it's a real mystery to me. I understand why they oppose their ideas. I think some of it does drive them crazy, and I feel for them that way, and I vowed never to let Governor Bush drive me equally crazy, because they seemed odd people to pick as villains. I remember once Newt Gingrich called them countercultural McGovernicks. Now, these are people who spend New Year's Eve at a Renaissance weekend talking public policy and singing God Bless America at the stroke of midnight. Not my idea of countercultural McGovernicks, whatever that means. I've never understood the personal animus, the hatred, and it is raw. Terry, I got hate mail like you wouldn't believe just from working for him.
Just to tell me about some of what you got.
Oh, volumes and volumes, really. I mean, just stacks and stacks. When I left the White House, my assistant gave me many volumes of loose leaf binders that she'd collected. I found it inspirational. I mean, a lot of it just hateful and bigoted, but some of it quite inspirational. I figured if we're making the kooks that angry, we're doing something right.
I heard that during the Gore-Bush debates, that Gore's aides played him tapes of the Saturday Night Live parodies of the debates so he could see what he was doing wrong or what people perceived that he was doing wrong. Did you ever play tapes of comics impersonating Bill Clinton to give him a sense of what people were responding to, for better or worse, about his mannerisms or his way of speaking?
No, and in fact, in fairness to the Gore gang, I was around for those debate preps because I played Bush for Gore in those mock debates, and they really just played him those tapes for fun. They thought they were funny sketches. In the campaign, we played Clinton all the Saturday Night Live spoofs on his campaign, not to teach him any lessons. We just thought they were funny, and Clinton's got an enormous ability to laugh at himself. There were long stretches, of course, where the topics of the jokes, particularly on the late night shows, were too painful and too personal, and he would just tune them out. He was the first president, I think, in the television era who didn't have a television in his office. It'll be interesting to see if a president-elect Bush changes that and goes back to, you know, LBJ had three televisions going all the time, plus the UPI and the AP wires. Clinton had no media in his office. He didn't have any wires.
What?
He didn't have any computer.
Especially in the CNN era, and now MSNBC era as well.
I think he liked being one step removed. He came into my office once, and I had the TV going, of course, all the time on these news networks. And it was somebody, you know, screaming and yelling about what a horrible man he was. And he put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, "Why do you watch this stuff?" And I said, "Well, sir, so you don't have to." And he did. He kind of laughed and said, "Okay, well, good for you. I couldn't take it." I think it's important, and it was a learned skill on the part of President Clinton, who used to devour anything that was about him in the press. It was a learned skill to step back from that, and a healthy one. And I think that it probably helped the president to not see the day-to-day news coverage of that whole thing.
I wonder if you're leaving the Clinton era with a sense of optimism or pessimism about American politics.
Well, you know,
having
writ large.
Lived through the impeachment, yeah.
Right. In the big picture, in the big sense of things, very optimistic. That we can get a lot done in this country, and the politics matters. And that it can be on the level that you can go to the country and you can say, "Look, if you make me president, I'll cut the deficit, I'll revive the economy, I'll address welfare and crime, I'll do the best that I can to solve these ancient hatreds in the Middle East and Northern Ireland." And then he went and did all those things. I mean, I wrote half of those campaign speeches, and they were not just pie in the sky; they were a whole floating bakery. And doggone it, if he didn't do it all. So in that sense, I leave very optimistic. I have a lot of friends who work for Governor Bush because I'm from Texas, and I worry about them in the small and personal ways that you worry about your friends. I've seen more friends that I can count financially ruined and emotionally destroyed by this politics of personal destruction. I do hope that President Bush has an easier go of it, that his political adversaries don't mistake him for an enemy and try to take him down by any means necessary the way the right did against Clinton. I think that's what's been difficult and disillusioning, is the abuse of the law, of prosecutorial apparatus, and of journalism to such a vicious and vindictive end. And I hope, as maybe one of the faces of the loyal opposition against Governor Bush, I hope just to give him hell every day, but not to cross that line and try to pretend that just because I think he's wrong politically that somehow we have to put him in prison.
Paul Begala, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure.
Paul Begala is President Clinton's former political advisor. This is Fresh Air.